Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour has been in the teaching field for 40 years, and she has spent a good deal of time talking about the strong relationships that encourage learner exploration, dialogue, confidence, and mutual respect, a strong relationship between the teacher and the student. She writes, for every student that finally got it, for every rookie teacher that said, you inspired me to stay, I get the raise that never quite made it to my paycheck. She has made it her business to know everything that she could about her students, where they lived, with whom, how often they changed schools, how many siblings they had, whether or not they lived in a house or in an apartment, whether there was trauma or drama in the household. She went on home visits, shopped in the neighborhood stores so she could be certain to run into her students. And that's also a place where you can have pretty good parent-teacher conferences. Professor Rita Pearson is an educational trainer and consultant, a motivational speaker, a teacher and author, a human resource developer, and has taught at every level of the public school spectrum. She's a licensed professional counselor and has served as an elementary school administrator and guidance counselor. And she is with us this hour to talk about that relationship. Our number, for all of you who are interested in education, and I'm interested in hearing from teachers this hour as well, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Rita Pearson, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's start with just the field of education. You really don't make very much money, you write. It's not deemed worthy of news coverage unless there's a scandal or a strike, the whole teaching profession. And yet, the accomplishments that you can feel as a human being are fairly enormous.
You know, I still believe that teaching is a calling, and it has to be something that you do because you have the desire deep within. But today's students can be a challenge. I don't want to in any way appear to sugarcoat that everything is wonderful in the field, even in spite of the low pay. You know, we have such a great working environment. Sometimes the kids are tough, and sometimes the schools are tough, and so I don't want to paint a picture that it's all, you know, sweet wine and roses, because it is a challenge, and that's why it has to be a calling.
Mm-hmm. You write about and talk about the paperwork can be overwhelming, and you found yourself early in your career, perhaps, questioning the choice, and yet you couldn't find another profession that brought, as you just said, a joy and a huge challenge pretty much every day.
Well, you know, I come from a long line of teachers. My parents were teachers, my grandparents were teachers, and I flirted with the idea of doing something else, but nothing else ever quite felt right. And I've taught special ed and regular ed students, and, you know, I've just kind of done the circle, and I, you know, just could not find myself wanting to do something else that would probably bring me the joy that teaching did. So I kind of just stayed where I was. Now, counseling I always thought of as an extension of teaching, because I think to be a good teacher, you have to also be a good counselor. And so that was one of the reasons I went that direction, but it still kept bringing me back to children.
Mm. Well, was it your grandmother or your mother? Tell me the story of all the things that she used to put in her desk drawer for students. Your mother. It's a great story.
She just used to keep her desk filled with things that kids might need, like hairbrushes and combs and food. There was always crackers and raisins, something that kids could eat right away. She said, we always take for granted that everybody had a good breakfast, or that everybody has parents who are dedicated to making sure that kids have everything they need. And sometimes parents are overwhelmed, and there are just some holes that need to be filled. So she always wanted to make sure her kids were not fighting to learn and to feel good about themselves at the same time. And so she said, well, if a kid was dirty, then she had a washcloth and some soap, and it was always done privately. And I can remember those things being in her desk drawer. So a lot of the behaviors and habits that I picked up were a direct result of watching what she was doing.
And there are a lot of teachers who may not do exactly that, but there are a lot of teachers who pad their own not very large paychecks to get things for their students, aren't there?
Absolutely. I don't know of any teacher who doesn't spend some money out of their own pockets. It's just one of those things that just kind of happens. You know, if you don't want to fill out a requisition for this or a requisition for that, and sometimes there's no requisition to be had. I never was the teacher that got a stipend for bulletin board materials or any of that. Some school districts do that now, but all of that was out of pocket. And I know for a fact that there are teachers who still spend a great deal of their own money, but it's never really talked about because it's just kind of one of those things that's understood.
Right. Now, let's talk about the relationship between teacher and student. I think this is remarkable what you did. You wanted to know everything you could about your students. You shopped in the same stores they went to so you could run into your students.
Well, I wanted to increase the possibility. And again, that was an idea that I got from my mom. I didn't come up with that idea on my own. Before we would go home some days after school, she says, well, I'm just going to stop right in here, and I'll bet you I'll see somebody's mom. And invariably, she would either run into students or she'd run into their parents. And I picked up the practice, especially when I worked in a community that was isolated or transportation was limited, and so there was no large, you know, grocery store chain nearby, so they would be forced to shop in some of the stores that were nearby, some of the mom-and-pop stores or some of the smaller convenience stores. And so it increased my chances of running into one of my students, and which said to them, which is what I hope said to them, that I care enough about you to shop where you shop and to get some of the things that I need from the same place you get the things that you need. And it was just a subtle way of bridging the gap between teacher, student, and creating a relationship that could not be written down or evaluated. It was just there.
Mm-hmm. And a good place to have a parent-teacher conference, because sometimes parents can't come to the teacher conferences at school.
And, well, you know what? And even if they did come to parent-teacher conferences at school, it was just another way of embedding a connection between the two of us. When I would volunteer for car rider duty, or even when I was assigned car rider duty, when parents come around and pick up their kids, you know, just to lean in the window and have a couple of sentences exchanged between whoever's driving the car and you, it just makes a difference. You know, when you know people's names and when you say, okay, you know, Jeffrey had a really good day today, I just wanted to let you know that. And that's leaning in someone's car window. Any opportunity that you get to connect with any of the students or their parents or the relatives or whoever is helping to raise this child increases the likelihood that you are trusted. And I think that there's so much mistrust between the schoolhouse and the home now, because, you know, you see so many negative stories about, you know, what's going on between kids and teachers, that any opportunity or way that we can get to increase the likelihood that parents trust us, it says that when I call you when there is a problem, that you're likely to listen to me because I'm just not some voice in the night. You know me.
Mm-hmm. Professor Pearson, isn't that asking a whole lot and maybe too much of teachers?
If you overthink it, yes. You can't overthink it. It has to be something you just do. I'm going to ask you about your brother. I'm going to ask you, how did you have a good night's sleep? It's not some laundry list that I have in front of me. It just comes up in natural conversation. I want to know, you know, and kids tell you everything. When I say, what happened, you know, did you have a good night? No, I didn't. My brother and my mom fussed all night, and so now I know something happened last night. So if I don't get your homework, I have some idea as to maybe why I didn't get your homework. Mm-hmm. Doesn't change the fact that you got to do it. It just changes the way I might get it from you. And so, no, it's not asking a lot. But if you sit down and think, now I've got to do this, 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 and this, and you make yourself a list, it becomes overwhelming. But when it becomes a natural part of what you do as you conduct your day, it's not a piece of paper. It's not a document that you have to fill out. It's not anything somebody's going to check. It's just a part of what you do to create relationship.
And what about the amount that you disclosed about yourself to your students?
All kids are so surprised when they know something about you, it get, that again creates a connection. I remember once I told my students that I was sleepy. I was having some young ladies in my office for lunch, and I said I had to go sleep in the guest bedroom last night because my husband was snoring. And so they said, you have a guest bedroom, a room in your house just for guests? And I said, well, yeah. And they said, well, how loud was he snoring? And I said, oh, pretty loud. And so they just had the biggest laugh about that. But it was not a part of a school business. It wasn't about any academic subject. It was about me being tired and why. And if you have pictures of your family on your desk, if you just, kids are going to ask you, who is that? Mm-hmm. So the personal pieces of you, they really enjoy hearing about because it says you're a person, too.
We welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Rita Pearson. She is has been in the education field for 40 years now. That's a good long time at just about every level you could possibly imagine. She's now an educational trainer and consultant and motivational speaker, and actually came to our attention because of her TED Talk, which is linked to our Facebook page. So if you'd like to see her and hear her in action, go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can hear her extended thoughts about this relationship between teacher and student. She is a licensed professional counselor as well. She's been an elementary school administrator, guidance counselor, developed a school community involvement program for a large elementary school, organized and trained an in-school crisis team for students in need of immediate intervention, and she earned her doctorate in educational administration and master's in guidance and counseling. And we're talking about the teaching profession and how that relationship between teacher and student is all important. What do you think? We welcome your phone calls, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, which is open for your comments and where you can see that TED Talk, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, the author of Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. He'll explore the theory that the dissonance between our digital selves and our analog bodies has thrown us into a new state of anxiety. That's tomorrow at 10. Let's go to phone calls for Professor Rita Pearson, and we start with Dave in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Dave.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
Hey, my experience is as an ESL instructor, and I spent a year in South Korea, and I spent a couple years in Germany.
Mm.
And I have to say that without any sort of training, I went to South Korea, and my first few months were miserable. Like, I had no idea how to interact with the students, and I came in with, you know, like, buttoned down, sort of, you know, wearing the shirt and tie sort of thing, and it had no idea, like, how to, like, what that space between the students and myself should be.
Mm-hmm.
And that was extremely, it was an anxiety-filled experience for me. Like, to find out how personal I could be, you know, with my students, you know, but, and they range from kindergarten to adult, you know, but they were really, what I came to find out after a few months of doing it was that they really wanted to know who I was, you know, and that barrier between, you know, between us needed to diminish in order for me to be effective as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And that took me a while to figure that out. And it felt strange to, and there are cultural differences, of course, that, you know, come into play. For example, I made the mistake one time of patting a child on the head to say, you did a good job, but culturally, that's a major insult.
Oh.
You know, like, you never do that, and I didn't know that, you know, and so that was a weird experience in that regard. But I found that in my South Korean experience, you know, it's just a feeling. When it clicks, you know, you sort of get it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you feel like, okay, now I know what that space between, you know, means and, mm-hmm. and how to deal with that.
Professor Pearson.
Yes. I believe that one of the things that we don't do at the university level is really emphasize how valuable the relationship piece is to teaching. And they tell us how to dress appropriately, and appropriately is really what is good for the group you're working with. And you found that out. It took you some trial and error, but you did find that out. There are periods when class and the rule systems that you live with and the cultural components have to cross over each other. And when you learn all facets, it helps you to create a much stronger relationship. The more you know about the culture, the more you know about the economic lens through which your students are looking at the world, and the more you have the ability to share yourself personally, the stronger your academic self is accepted.
Hmm. Tell me about your very early days, Dr. Pearson, when you were just teaching. Did you have the same struggle that Dave did of not knowing how much to reveal about you and being just a little bit nervous about the whole prospect?
Not so much.
No.
And I think it was basically because my background was from being raised in a family where that was a given.
I see.
So I didn't know any other way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably gave away too much information as opposed to not enough, but it never came back, thank goodness. It never came back to haunt me. But I believe that we spend so much time in teacher preparation on so many other things, we never embed this piece. And I think universities are becoming more and more aware of it, and that is a good thing because now we're seeing and it really does create more teacher confidence. If you feel like, you know, you're not so tied to just one specific area, that it gives you a chance to branch out. Now, a lot of this, too, is based on your own personal set of hidden rules or the personal set of pieces that you bring to the table.
Yes.
Some people are very open and apt to create relationship faster, but it doesn't mean that you can't create a good relationship because kids have an uncanny knack of knowing which teachers do what, and they accept you for who you are as long as they know that I accept you, I'm caring about you, but I don't allow you to slouch off just because I care about you. That's not an open invitation for you not to work. And that, too, has been a piece that was criticized. If we get too close to kids, then they'll think we're easy. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Mm. Hey.
The closer I am to you, the more I expect from you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we've kind of had a bad idea about education being all sappy and syrupy when that is not what I'm saying.
Yeah. Thanks, Dave, very much for the call. And you've worked with some students. I love some of these techniques that you've used where students have been underachieving. You give a test and there's 18 wrong and 2 right, and you highlight the 2 right, and holy Toledo, what a difference that can make to a student.
You know, someone, I've worked for a very long time with Ruby Payne, who is the author of A Framework for Understanding Poverty. And one of the things that we talk about in my presentations is the fact that we emphasize the negative so much, we never look at the glass as half full. We always look at it as half empty. The same amount of water is in the glass. It's just all in the way you present it. I am currently on a long-term project in Waco, Texas, in community and family affairs. And a lot of the families that I'll be working with don't have a lot. And
mm-hmm.
So they don't need to have me emphasize what they don't have. We need to emphasize what you do have and how we can work from there to what you can possibly get. Anytime you tell people what they have and emphasize that, yeah, you've got this. It may not be much, but you've got it. And we're going to take that and work up. I don't need to tell you what you've done wrong. You already know that. I need to tell you what you've done right so we can move up.
Joanne in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Joanne.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Joanne.
Hi. I'm very interested in what your guest would have to say about residency. She talks about living in the communities where her students live and shopping in the convenience stores where they can see her every day. And, you know, here in Wisconsin and southeast Wisconsin, we have this controversy going about residency laws. Should you have to live in the city of Milwaukee to be able to teach in the city of Milwaukee? What does she feel about that?
Yeah, good question.
I mean, why? What will that make me a better teacher if I live where my kids live? Or is this an economic issue? Does this really have anything to do with relationships? I would want to know why I need to work in the area where I teach in. What is the purpose of that requirement? I can live anywhere I want to live and still create a relationship. It won't help me to know my students any better if I live in the neighborhood and I still don't come out of my house. Or if I live 100 miles away and I stay an extra hour or two every day just so I can, you know, be around in the community or go to one of my students' soccer game or softball game. So where I live is not as important as what I do while I'm there. So if it is the residency issue is about bringing more of a tax base to the community of the people who actually are part of that community, that's one thing. But if this is designed to increase relationship, it'll be a dismal failure because you can't make people like you. You can't make people want to do something they really don't want to do, no matter where you force them to live.
That's interesting. That's just the opposite of what I thought you would say.
Really?
Yes, I thought you would say that residency was valuable and should be required, but it's a very interesting perspective bring to the question.
What I think ought to be required is that teachers care about their kids. I don't care where you live. I don't need to be a part of where you live to know about where you live. You know, I don't, would it, you know, some people live in communities where they grew up in the neighborhood and they know all the people there, and that's great. But what if I'm new to the area and I just happen to move across town or I moved into an area where it's not near my school? That does not change the fact that if I want to actively participate in that community, I will stay later, come earlier, do the things in the community that I feel will enhance my relationships with the community residents. It doesn't have anything to do with where I live. It has to do with what I do while I'm there with you.
Interesting. Thank you, Joanne.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was a good question. David in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, David.
Happy spring.
Thanks, David. You too.
Let me get the plants in the ground here.
All right.
Pretty soon. Yeah, well, I recently retired, and I have also taught internationally in Bolivia and Chile. Mm. So I was a guidance counselor in Chile, and I was a physical education instructor in La Paz, Bolivia. And then I worked as a middle school guidance counselor, I don't know, for about 7 years. And then I was the at-risk coordinator in the middle school guidance counselor, wrote a lot of AODA grants, worked on an alternative program, which we started, and also started one in Colorado, too, was part of it. In my last 5 years, I worked as a guidance counselor but at the high school. But the reason I call this, I'm so happy your guest called because all the years I saw all these teachers work so hard, and we constantly got beat up, mainly by politicians, you know. And it was like, it was a different reality for me because I saw, just like your guest said, well, in our guidance office at the middle school, we actually had clothes for the kids and soap and towels, and sometimes kids were dirty. And, you know, we'd have them take a shower, and it just, you know, gave them food and, you know, all kinds of things like that, you know, way out of our way. And you know, I get so frustrated, you know, when I hear, you know, when I hear public schools mentioned, it's always our failing public schools. That was not our system. Mm. It was fantastic. Mm. And at the high school, if you took the AP classes and you took advantage of it, you got a good education. I used to tell the kids it's like, you know, 15 free minutes at the grocery store. Get in there, grab the lobsters, you know.
And I think if we teach all classes as if they were AP classes, we get a higher caliber of student. You know, if you know you've got kids who are performing low and you teach them low, they stay low. But if you're teaching kids who are not expected to do well, and you say all of a sudden you are caring teacher, and you walk in and say, you know, you guys can perform a lot better than you're doing, so here's how we're going to do it. And it is so difficult. I noticed what you mentioned about the schools, the clothing at the schools, and the ability to take a shower. If I don't have to be burdened with how I smell and whether I'm clean, I can learn a lot better. Kids can be vicious, they can be cruel, they can be hurtful, and when you don't smell good, you look different, you sound different because of the insecurities that you're feeling because of that. We can just eliminate a lot of that by just doing simple things. If I tell you, here's a washcloth, and, you know, head to the shower, and here's a deodorant, when you come back, your mind won't even be on that, and you won't have to worry about anybody saying anything to you. Now we can move on with the business.
Mm.
And so a lot of it was selfish. I didn't want to spend time on breaking up arguments over who smelled bad, and I don't want to work with him because she wore those clothes yesterday. See, we can eliminate all that and say, look, you know, here's a washcloth, here's a towel, go take care of that, and when you get back, we'll be done with that. And nobody ever knew. You know, I think the discretion of a teacher is so important, and you don't embarrass kids and call them out. And I think the gentleman who's calling right now had the right idea about, you know, let's just provide it
right.
And get done with it. And then we're on to something else. And, yeah, it is free 15 free minutes at the grocery store, get the lobster, because I'm not worried about the basics. I can go get the good stuff when I'm not worried about all those tedious things that so many people just take for granted.
And whoever thinks that teachers are dealing with all of these issues, you know, you say this, and I'm sure that it's fresh news to people's ears, Professor Pearson.
Well, you know, I think teachers get it. I think depends on where you teach. If you're teaching in what I call a frou-frou school where all your kids have everything they need, then you may not be faced with these kind of dynamics. But most of us, over the course of our careers, will get into schools that have different, varying economic standards.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got to know what each group needs. You might have a kid who's got all of the money needs taken care of, but maybe it's an emotional issue. Maybe it's his self-esteem. And so knowing what the group needs, knowing what the student needs, whether it's financial, whether it's emotional, whether it's spiritual, and by spiritual I don't mean church. I mean these kids just need some hope. And so when you realize what the needs are, you know where to target. So it's not always about the money or the stuff. It's just knowing what your kids need wherever you are.
Right. Thank you, David. I loved your call. Bill in Tomahawk. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good morning. My question about social promotion, I'd appreciate it if your guest would define it and then say what she thinks about it.
One, social promotion, I'm assuming, is what you call we just promote kids because they're too old, or we promote them or send them on to the next grade level because they've become a problem where they are and we just want to get them out of our building. Well, the problem with social promotion is that it doesn't solve anything. It's a in the present fix for something that's going to be long lasting, long after the kid is gone. And it's a real social, it's a injustice to socially promote. Here's my take on that. We have not done kids a service by not teaching them. And we keep talking about achievement gaps. It is really more of opportunity gaps. Our kids who are failing have not had many of the opportunities to achieve that a lot of the kids who do well have had. And so we owe it to poor kids and kids who've not had opportunity to insist that, number one, they know how to read. 99% of all of the failures in school are due to the fact that kids can't read. So to socially promote a kid who's not any more academically or socially ready to go on than he was when you got them is an injustice. So why not focus our time and attention on academic programming that will insist and encourage and promote that the kids that we promote and send on are able, and not spend so much time on getting them out of the building or getting them out of this classroom because they'll feel bad if they're taller than someone else or if they're older than someone else. I want to fix what's wrong with you while I have you so that when I do send you on, then you have the confidence and the know-how and the skill to hang on your own.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to respond to one of the earlier callers who said, you know, essentially that he felt that teachers were getting beat up, you know, are failing public schools, that they're not getting much support. Do you feel that the climate is pretty atrocious for teachers right now?
Depends on where you are, and it depends on your attitude. Some school districts are extremely supportive, and some people feel like they're not being supported at all. Here's my view on that. I think that a principal or a superintendent or whoever's above you does not owe you joy. They owe you a job. The atmosphere that is created within your classroom, within your school, is created by individuals within the unit. If you've got a failing grade level, then what have you guys done as a team to encourage each other? I never depended on my principal to spark me. I needed to spark myself. Is it true that good leadership will enhance and encourage great schools? Absolutely. But what do you do when you've got a terrible leader? What do you do if you've got a terrible boss?
Mm-hmm.
Do you just say, okay, I'm going to abandon these kids because I'm sad, because I feel like I'm not being supported?
Mm-hmm.
That's not fair to the children. So when I've worked in really uncomfortable situations, and there have been some, then I say to myself and to my team, okay, guys, we got a crap deal here. We did not get our fair shake. So that means that we've got to create the spirit and the spark and the desire within our own team. We create the fire over here.
Hmm.
And if you depend on somebody else to give you the fire, it may not happen, and then you're stuck. So I don't depend on anybody for joy or encouragement. If I get it, does it help me? Absolutely. But if I don't, I'm on about the business of creating it myself and finding some people who think like me.
Mm, and you've just said something that applies to people in so many jobs, right? Goes beyond teaching.
Oh, yeah. Because sometimes you get a really horrible boss. He's unfair. Is the culture of teaching, is the climate of teaching sometimes discouraging? Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, now we're being faced with, you know, your test scores aren't high enough, so we're going to put you on probation. And again, you know, somebody, many times, people who legislate laws for teachers have never taught.
Yeah.
People who make rules for us, many times, are creating recipes, and they never been in the kitchen.
Right.
And you know, and it's unfair.
Yeah.
It's unfair. You know, you tell us how to cook a meal, but you never been to the restaurant. So if we don't stand up, teachers notoriously do not stand up and say, that's not how you do it. We know how to create a meal. We know what makes kids learn. We know what encourages kids. And we're going to do that because we know what makes it work. We got to say that, and we got to prove that we can do that.
Chris in Shorewood is next. Hi, Chris.
Oh, what a joy to listen to you talk. I just finished 60 years of teaching from kindergarten to the university and back. And I wish that you could go with me this Thursday night to the Milwaukee School Board meeting, because the teachers in Milwaukee are fantastic teachers in the public school. They do a marvelous job, but they have terrible, terrible situation in that they have students more. The vouchers and charters have been taking the top skim of kids away, and MPS is left with the exceptional ed mainstreamed, and they're left with many, many children in a class. When a teacher has six classes a day of 30 or 40, it's very difficult for them to interact one-on-one, and that's what teachers have been asking for forever. Not a lot of fancy stuff, but a smaller class so that they can do their own counseling, their own calling. I can remember going to a home in the inner core because the parents couldn't come out. I can remember visiting a kid who couldn't read, and he said, oh, Miss Chris, can I tell a story? I visited, and he was in a home with nothing in the living room, not a book. So if I had said to that kid, oh, just take a book home and read at night, he had nothing.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a response.
And that has always, you know, been one of our fallacies, our drawbacks. We assume that there's somebody at home that can help you. Oh, mm-hmm. Take that home and get your mom or dad to help you with that homework. When I said that many of our kids, the achievement gap is not, the gap is about opportunity. That's what I was talking about. Can we create almost intolerable conditions for teachers? Can administrations do that? Yes, they can. It is unthinkable in 2013 to believe that you can get any kind of academic thing going with a classroom of 40 kids
mm-hmm.
for 50 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not even logical. Now, I grew up in a time when 30 to 40 kids in a classroom was normal, but the school rooms were much, much larger. The teachers had a much closer relationship with the community, and it was normal. Now that's not normal. Our schoolrooms are much smaller. Our teachers are younger. They've not had a lot of the training, and we are offering much less staff development now than we used to. So we're sending teachers out there with not enough training. One of the reasons Finland, a very small country, has such an enormously successful school is because they have small classes. They don't do standardized testing, and the professional development is constant, continuous, and fabulous. And so for us to continue to do the things that we've been doing wrong for the last 30, 40 years, to keep doing the same thing expecting different results, is crazy. Jeffrey Canada says that. So the only thing I can say about the teachers that you're going to see on Thursday night is that they get together and figure out how to make it work with what they've got. If that's what it's going to take, I may have to divide my class of 40 into four or five small groups so that I can just circulate around the classroom. Or we can all get together and say we just can't keep doing it like this,
mm-hmm.
and have a unified voice that speaks to what education really needs. But right now we spend so much time just arguing in the parking lot about how bad it is, but we're not an organized voice, and that hurts us.
Yeah. Thanks, Chris, very much for your call. We're talking about teaching this hour of the program. Our guest came to our attention because of a TED Talk she did, which is really good. It's linked to our Facebook page for those of you who want to carry this conversation further. Rita Pearson has been in education for 40 years now. She's taught at every level. She is now an educational consultant. She provides her experience, and as you can tell, her wisdom for people in all areas of education. She's also a licensed professional counselor, has been an elementary school administrator, in addition to having taught at every level of the public school spectrum. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, should you care to leave a comment there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Karen in Rolling Stone is next. Hi, Karen.
Hi, what a wonderful program, and what a wonderful guest. I'm also a teacher who taught for over 40 years and retired a few years ago. I was so fortunate early in my career to be in a school where there was a third grade teacher, and I happened to be a special reading teacher at the time, so I was in her classroom quite a lot, and this was so long ago. She had a long name, but it started with B, and she called herself Miss B to make it easier for all the kids, and she called her classroom the Beehive. And in that classroom, she was like magic with those children. And one day I said, oh, you know, what are your secrets? And she said, well, every child comes into this classroom with three questions taped on their forehead that I can see, but they can't. The first question is, do you know who I am? And the second question is, do you care about me? And the third question is, can I trust you?
Mm.
And in the springtime that year, I happened to be in her room on the day when she was going to start talking about moving on to fourth grade with her children. And she believed, and I came to believe as a result of watching her, that social promotion didn't always work for every child, and sometimes children just needed an extra year. And so she said to the children on that day, "Oh, it's time where we start thinking about you're leaving the beehive, and you're going to be moving on to fourth grade, and I'm excited for you, and I just know that there are some of you who would like to stay here with me for another year. Could we see a show of hands?" Well, in a room of 25 children, probably 15 raised their hands. And she said, "I would love to be able to have all of you." But then the fourth grade teacher wouldn't have very many students in her class, and she's looking forward to that. And I'll be getting some new children from second grade, but I'm going to talk to the principal, and I'm going to see if we could make room for some of you.
Wow, how nice. I love
great idea.
Yeah, I love those questions, too, that are on the forehead of each student. Aren't those are important questions.
Yeah, the first one, the do you know who I am?
Right.
You know, don't we all want to know that? Do
mm-hmm.
you know who I am? And do you care
mm-hmm.
about me? I think that once that's taken care of, once I can believe that, you know, can I trust you? Even when you find out who I am, can I trust you with that? And all year, you're kind of proven whether you can answer those questions or not. And believe it or not, the academic piece won't stick nearly as long with the kids as will the answers to those three questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are important. Thanks, Karen, for the call. Alan in Milwaukee. Hi, Alan.
First of all, I'd like to say it's a privilege to talk after Miss Chris. She taught my kids many years ago, and she was a wonderful teacher. Hi, Miss Chris. I taught at UWM for 30 years. I've been retired for 20. And I would like to say the following, that I think it's very important never to make fun of students if they ask a silly question.
Right.
However strange it may be, the best thing is don't smile, just answer it as best you can. That's one advice I would give to teachers. Another thing is that you have to have a good knowledge of your subject and a good knowledge of general subjects so that you can fit your subject into the world. And this makes it interesting for students. And I love teaching at UWM. UWM is a great school, and we have great education in Wisconsin.
I believe it. And you are so right, and we have not touched on that at all, about teacher competency. I think you need to be so, so very willing to study your lesson as a teacher. If you don't know what you're talking about, it makes it very hard for somebody to learn from you. So in addition to create the power of relationships, there's also the power of your being able to give what you know to someone else. And being a what people call a people person does not substitute for excellence in what you do. So I think along with the creation of relationships, the gentleman was absolutely correct. You need to know your subject matter. And if you don't know it, that's all right. But there's not knowing is not the biggest issue. Continuing to not know.
Mm-hmm.
is the big problem. And so to just say I'm not good in math or I'm not good in reading, I am not good in math. It was not one of my favorite things to do. But I tried very, very, very hard to make sure that what lesson I taught was taught competently. And so teacher competence is way up on my list of things that are necessary. We let far too many teachers gain access to the classroom who are not willing to work hard, and we have a very difficult time getting rid of them. I don't know of any other corporate entity that passes incompetence around in a circle like education does.
Hmm.
If you are not a good teacher, if you are proven to not have the ability to connect with your students, to provide solid teaching, then you should be fired.
Yeah. And competence and enthusiasm, and then having your student carry on that enthusiasm. I can remember great English teachers. I still read Charles Dickens and Shakespeare, and because of not only of the competence, but the great passion for a subject.
Exactly.
That goes directly into a student.
And you know what? It's infectious. If you're excited about what you're doing, then you invariably are going to have some kids who are excited about you.
Absolutely.
Especially if they like you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Linda in Madison, hi.
Hi there. I was just looking to get some quick comments from your guest about other opportunities for teachers to develop relationships with their kids. And I worked as an educational assistant for several years in a couple of different districts here in Wisconsin, and then also offered bilingual resource support. And I found that in my very first year at a school, by the end of the year, I was getting invited to dinners at families' homes or different cultural events that they were taking part of in the community, or perhaps a student's new sibling's baptism or something like that. And a lot of the teachers around me were amazed that I had this kind of in with some of these families. And to me, what I thought part of the issue was a barrier between the teachers and the students was that nowadays teachers are not required to sit in the cafeteria and lunch with their students. Educational assistants are the ones who are there at drop-off time and the breakfast that might be offered and recess time and pickup time. And the teachers aren't doing any of those things anymore. And I guess I would just wonder if your guest thinks that not having teachers be a part of that is justified because of all of the work that they might have to do, or if she feels rather that that would be an important part of the school day for teachers to be more involved in. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned was, would it be better if teachers were required to do that? I think in schools that work, there is equal division of labor. Schools that are excellent, I see principals doing car rider duty. I see assistant principals doing cafeteria duty. In schools where the labor is severely divided, teachers teach and assistants do the other things, you don't see the camaraderie among staff members, nor do you see the relationship development with students and school personnel. In one of the buildings where I worked, the custodian was in charge of boys' day because he was a great guy, and the principal recognized that he had the ability to develop rapport with those young men. And we had so few men in the building, and you know, Mr. Wilson just took that on. And so nobody said, oh, he's the custodian, so he can't do that. Or you're the teacher aide, so you can't do this, this, and this, and you're the teacher, and you don't have to. When everybody decides that these children in this campus, on this campus, belong to all of us, and any opportunity that we have to create a closer bond with them, we take it, that school is apt to do a lot better
than schools
who don't.
Yeah.
So she's right. The more you know, if you're on car ride or you've got bus duty or you're in the cafeteria during lunch and you're doing pickup, then yes, you're going to see parents and you're going to see kids. But there was a time, though, when teachers had to do it all. We had to do lunch. We had to do recess. We had to do it all. And because there were no teacher assistants, there were no teacher aides, there were no outside ancillary personnel who could help us. But now that we do have those folks, it's unfair to say, okay, only those people do the duties, and the rest of us who sit a little bit higher on the educational hog, we don't do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That is a specific divide that does not create campus unity, and it does not create relationships.
Mm. Thank you, Linda, so much for the call. Well, you have been wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us. Do you have any plans to be in Wisconsin in the future?
You know, not in the near future.
All right. Well, somebody bring her in. Yeah, she's you're resonating with everybody here in Wisconsin. Thank you, Rita Pearson, so much for being with us.
And thank you for asking me to be a guest. And best of educational luck to your listeners and to all of the students who are part of your public education system and private education system, for that matter.
Thank you. Rita Pearson, educational trainer and consultant now. She's a motivational speaker. You can see her TED Talk on our Facebook page. Many of you may want to go right there right now if you have time to do so. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show. She has been an educator for 40 years, working at all levels in the public school spectrum. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this highly interesting show, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Lots of great conversations ahead, so please stay with us, and we'll return tomorrow at 9 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network.